Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice. Thanks for joining us today.
And once again, we're diving into A Gypsy's Kiss. We are getting very close to the end. We are on chapter 37 and 38 today. I think 38 is one of my favorite chapters.
Why do you say that?
Probably because I wrote most of it, because it was something that wasn't didn't actually happen, but we were trying to explore a few more character traits and, you know, just kind of expose those character traits and cement them in, I think, before arriving at in Santa Fe or in Lamy.
Back in hell.
Yeah, back on the train to where you ended up. I think we addressed some things that, you know, you'd been thinking and tossing around in your mind, and this was a good way to illustrate those things in a, you know, in a more visual way.
I think when you wrote it, as I was reading what you had written, it sounded plausible, mm-hmm. in terms of how the story had been progressing thus far, and it needed this kind of point. We hadn't actually delineated this point in the character or this characteristic of the individual up until this point.
So yeah, I think it was also one of those signposts or mileposts in the hero's journey that we hadn't hit yet.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
We got to hit that. So what are we going to talk about? So we wrote this chapter.
So when Shelley and I told you we wrote this book together, we wrote this book together.
That's right. So as you may remember.
Wait a minute. I wanted to try something while you're reading.
All right. What are we trying? Reading. Oh, you want to do music?
Yeah, hang on.
While I'm reading? It might be annoying for people.
I think. All right.
Yeah. If they don't like the music, it's going to be annoying for them. All right. You may remember that Miguel is on the train. He was put on the train by the New Orleans police and sent to go back home. And it was going to take 3 days. And while he was on the train, he met Mr. Kudrow, who was the train conductor. And he found some books and magazines to read to keep his mind busy. And other than napping and looking out the window, he would walk back and forth in the train and just to get a little exercise every now and then. And yeah, that's where we're at. He's still on the train.
Now, there were some stops along the way that mm-hmm. I would get out yeah. long enough to see if there were snacks or, you know, anything
stretch
else.
Your legs again.
Yeah, stretch a leg. So
get some fresh air.
But so I wasn't stuck, literally stuck on the train.
Right. All right. Okay. This one is called Chapter 37, Paper and Pen. In one of the reveries of just staring out the window and running everything through my head, it registers that I have to make a plan for my life going forward. But before that, I have to make a clear decision. As a member of the National Forensics Society and the St. Michael's High School forensics team, I had learned much to prepare for debates and stints of extemporaneous speaking. It always started with a notepad and a pen to develop a set of goals and objectives. That was followed by establishing the pros and cons of each point that I wanted to make, and then finally deciding upon what position I wanted to promote in my debate or extemporaneous speech. It's not quite planning my future, but it gives me a place to start. Looking around the train car, I watch as Mr. Kudrow visits with the other passengers, asking how they're doing and if they need anything. A mother and her young daughter ask about the industry and construction they see out the window, and he beams as he shares the stories he knows about them. A businessman asks him for the correct time, and it turns into a lively conversation full of jokes and cheerfulness. Mr. Kudrow seems to me to be a generous person who often finds satisfaction and joy in solving problems and fulfilling requests for his passengers. So the next time he and I visit, I ask him if he has some paper and a pen I could use. Looking up and tapping his index finger against his chin, before turning back and pointing his finger at me, he says, "There's a drawer in the desk in the library. In it, you'll find some stationery and envelopes and a fine linen paper provided by the Southwestern Railroad Company." He reaches inside his suit jacket and withdraws a fine fountain pen. He hands it to me, saying, "I'll lend you my pen, but I want you to know it's my only pen and a favorite of mine, so I'd like to get it back when you're done." I promise him I will return it once I finish and follow him back toward the library in the next car. As he passes the desk in the library in front of me, he grandly gestures to the drawer before continuing on to the next car. I open the drawer, and sure enough, there is a small stack of a khaki-colored fine linen stationery and matching envelopes with the Southwestern Railroad logo embossed onto each sheet. I take three sheets out and sit down at the desk to compose my thoughts. I start by making a list of my personal goals, focusing on the long-term and important things that I want to accomplish in my life. Finish school, find Mariah, recover the lost treasure, travel, seek adventure. I wonder what my high school friends would think about these goals. Most of our goals seem to revolve around one of three things: sports, girls, and cars, and occasionally college. If we do think much about our future, it's only for as long as necessary, usually as part of a school assignment, and then we go back to thinking about sports, girls, and cars. Writing out my goals helps me organize my thoughts, and I ask myself the best way to achieve them all. Can I do it on my own? Do I need more education? Aren't there men and women of great stature and wealth who started working at a very young age, foregoing an education, and making their way by hard work and creative ideas? Next, I make a list of pros and cons for my current situation. The first choice: step off the train and find my own way in life. Alternatively, stay on the train and live the life that others have planned for or expect of me. I think back to Dave and his insistence that he had to go to MIT and become an engineer because it was expected of him, whether he liked it or not. Then I think about my family's plan for me, which amounts to doing what my father had wanted to do with his life, become an attorney and politician. But his plans were thwarted by his parents. Why are kids always pressured by their parents to follow their plans? That lack of choice grates against my senses and reminds me of that authority figure adage, "my way or the highway." I want to change that phrase to serve my purposes instead. Perhaps my way is the highway. Looking over my list, it boils down to choosing between freedom or not freedom. Using Mr. Kudrow's fine fountain pen, I write the word freedom at the bottom of the page and underline it for emphasis. Capping his pen, I carefully fold the sheet and slip it into my back pocket. The next chapter is chapter 38, Three Steps to Freedom. And there's a photo of Mom and Dad at the bullring in Juarez. And we included that because Miguel's going to be ending up in El Paso. So we want to show you. If you are listening to the podcast, you can go to the video and check out the picture. And that's your mom and dad.
Good people.
This is Three Steps to Freedom. Mr. Kudrow shuffles down the aisle, calling out, "El Paso, next stop, El Paso. We'll be there in 20 minutes. If you disembark, listen for the departure announcement so we don't leave without you." I remain in my seat until the train comes to a complete stop and all the passengers in my car depart. I collect my belongings, sling my satchel over my shoulder, walk the few steps to the back of the car, turn toward the station, and take the measure of all the emotions I am experiencing. Excitement, anxiety, guilt, pride, and a jumbled bucket full of other feelings pour through me. El Paso. I'm a mile away from the border. I can cross it and continue south, and if I like, travel all the way to the tip of South America. I may not be fully prepared for this adventure, but I'm not ready to go back home. I don't choose that path for myself. All the pros on my back pocket list add up to freedom. Taking a deep breath, I purposefully take 3 steps down and onto the platform. I feel more free already. I survey the train station with fresh independence to decide what to do next. One more step, and a little girl with wavy brown hair wearing a pink dress and a matching pink beret halts my progress. She is running and merrily shrieking while looking over her shoulder and not in the direction she is going. As she almost crashes into my legs, I swoop down and pick her up before she can run into me or anyone else, or worse, off the edge of the platform. Looking in the direction from which she came, I try to locate her parents, who must be looking for her. As I pick her up, she stops everything, uncertain what is happening and why this stranger is suddenly holding her perched on his hip. After one look at me, she reaches back, starts squirming, and calling out, "Mommy, Mommy!" My first reaction is to put her down, but the woman, Mommy, shouts, "Hold on to her, please!" as she runs in my direction, followed by 2 other children, both of them younger than the girl I am holding. As soon as she is close enough, I hand her the little girl and she calms her down, then turns to look at me to say, "Thank you, I'm sorry." No need to apologize. I wanted to stop her before she ran off the edge of the platform. She got away from me when I wasn't looking. Releasing her irritation and switching to politeness, the woman nods at me. "I'm Dorothy Dalton. This little scamp is my daughter, Erica, and these are her brothers, Jason and Carl." Dorothy is dressed in a gray skirt and matching gray and pink plaid jacket, short-heeled black dress shoes, and carrying a black purse. She appears to be in her late 20s or early 30s. Her dark wavy hair is topped with a pink beret that matches the one little Erica wears. Jason is a handsome, brown-eyed little boy about 4 years old, wearing a white sailor shirt and shorts with navy trim that matches the one baby Carl, who stands clinging to Dorothy's leg, is wearing. Jason seems very interested in the trains and points to them as he names the different cars. "Hello, it's nice to meet all of you. My name is Miguel." I acknowledge each of them with a nod, and seeing she is still flustered and disorganized by the near mishap with Erica, I ask Dorothy, "What can I do to help?" With a sigh of relief, Dorothy answers, "Thank you. If you can hold their hands and follow me so I can get the baby back into his carriage, that would be very helpful." She puts Erica down. I hold her hand and she looks at me quizzically and then at her mother. Dorothy tells Erica, "It's okay, honey. Miguel is our new friend. Please hold his hand and don't run away again." Speaking to Jason, she says, "You hold his hand too, and let's take Carl back to the carriage." Dorothy picks up Carl, who is just barely walking age, and the 5 of us walk together toward the waiting baby carriage. She carefully puts Carl in his carriage, covers him with a small blanket, pulls a baby bottle from her purse, folds the nipple over tightly with her index finger, and shaking it, mixes the contents. Then she hands it to Carl in the carriage, and he happily takes it and sticks the nipple in his mouth to drink from it. She speaks calming words to each of the children, some of which I do not hear, but in each case I can make out the word "daddy." And then she asks them each to hold one side of the handle of the baby carriage. She turns to me, and her words tumble out in a rush. "Thank you very much for your help. It's been a terribly busy day. My husband, Robert, works for an oil company, and they're developing fields down in central Mexico. So he travels a great deal, and he's gone sometimes for months. It makes it very difficult for us. There are times," she confides, "when I feel like I'm raising the children all by myself. I almost forget that I'm married. It gets so busy. Robert promises me that someday things will change, that it will get better, and he won't have to do so much traveling. I hope and pray that day will come soon, because raising three young children without the help of their father, Dorothy's eyes begin to shed tears and a sob cuts off her words. Sometimes it just brings me to tears of frustration and loneliness. I'm sorry. Her cheeks redden and she covers her mouth with her fingertips. I shouldn't be telling you all my problems. I feel like I'm making a big mess of things. Dorothy's confession of her difficulties reminds me of my own mother and how she always reaches out to family like Tia Lucia, Uncle Carlos, and Uncle Mundi to help her manage the children. I suppose she feels inadequate to raise four children without my father. Acting on a masculine impulse to step up and help fix things, I offer. Can I get you anything? Something to drink would be very much appreciated, she responds with gratitude. Anything for the children, I ask. A box of animal crackers, if they have them, Dorothy suggests, as she looks toward the convenience store in the train station. They love those. Here, I'll just... Dorothy opens her purse and I gently gesture for her to stop by touching the back of her hand. I'll take care of it. I point to one of the wooden benches in the train station near us and say, sit there. I'll be back in just a minute. She looks toward the bench and nods, then reaches into her purse for a handkerchief to dry her eyes. Come along, children. Let's go sit on that bench, and Miguel is going to bring us a nice surprise. I go into the small store in the station, pull two cold bottles of Coca-Cola from the cooler, open them, pick up a couple of boxes of animal crackers, pay for everything, and return to where I had left Dorothy and the children. I ask her to hold both bottles while I open each box of crackers for the children. They sit back on the bench and enjoy examining each cracker and calling out its species before popping them happily into their mouths. She hands a bottle of Coke back to me and makes room for me to sit down with them. And you? She asks. Tell me about you. I'm on the train. I'm on my way to Santa Fe. That's your home? She asks. Your family is there? Yes. From where are you coming? New Orleans, I respond, and that leads to me telling her a shorter version of my travels, right up until the point that her daughter almost ran into me. I tell her that I lost my father when I was 11, and since then I have this sense of abandonment, especially after my mother sent me to boarding school. Dorothy fondly strokes Jason's hair. I think I understand why she might do that. What, send me to boarding school? Yes. I worry about my boys growing up without their father around to teach them how to be good, strong, and kind men. She gently tugs the blanket down to cover Carl's feet as he sleeps in the carriage before turning her gaze to me. Sending you to live with the good, strong, kind Christian brothers may be her way of making sure you have the best role models she can provide. A small flickering light of understanding sparks in my brain. I ignore it by telling myself my mother sent me to boarding school so she wouldn't have to deal with me. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Besides, I have things in my life that I want to accomplish. I've got my back pocket list, and if I go home now, I'll never achieve those goals. Maybe, I concede, just to be polite. I take a long drink of my Coke, enjoying the scratchy bubbles in my throat and the boost of energy from the sugar. Then I tell her, I've decided to cross the border and head south, maybe find some work in the oil fields. That's the kind of freedom I'm looking for. It's the kind of freedom I need. She tells me that when she was my age, she had goals too, some of them very similar to mine. But her father convinced her that it was better to get an education because it would provide more options in life. It was a good choice for a number of reasons, including having met her husband, whom she loves, and who she knows loves her. She explains, I don't think Robert understands how difficult, tiring, and frustrating it is to raise the children without him. But I know one day he'll return home and have no other reason to leave, and we can raise our family together. Every household needs a man. Erica and Jason show each other their animal crackers. Jason holds up a cracker, exclaiming, Horsey! Erica examines the cracker and informs Jason sweetly, That's a camel. See the hump? Jason looks carefully at the hump and says, Camel, before biting the hump off the cracker and showing it to Erica again. Horsey! Jason and Erica squeal with laughter, and we join in with them. I wonder what it must seem like to them every time their father gets on a train and disappears for days, weeks, or months, and how hard that must be on them, and on Dorothy as well. An announcement blares from the public address system. Train number 830 on track 2, bound for Albuquerque, all aboard. That's your train, Dorothy says to me. You have a choice to make now, Miguel. Go home or cross the border. Looking at the children, I compare them with my little sister, Rita, and my little brothers, Vincent and Paul. I picture my mother asking for help from my aunts and uncles and the Christian brothers because of how hard it is for her to raise her children alone. If I don't go home, it won't lighten her load. It will only add to it. What will happen to my family if I don't become the man my mother wants me to be? Who will I become if I choose a selfish path? My thoughts are interrupted as little Erica takes an elephant cracker out of the box on her lap and raises it to my mouth, offering it to me to eat as she declares, "Elephant." Before I can bite into it, memories blaze through my mind. My mother collects elephants from all over the world, on her own and with help from friends. The elephants are on display all around the house where my family lives, the house on Cortez Street in Santa Fe. Decision made, I stand up. I wish you all the best, Dorothy. You're a great mother, and your children are wonderful. I squat down to address Erica and Jason. You be good to your mother and take care of each other. I'm very happy I got to meet all of you today. Erica sets down her box of animal crackers and holds her arms out to me for a hug. I give her a quick squeeze and shake Jason's little hand. Dorothy smiles in approval. Thank you, Miguel. It was wonderful to meet you, too. Safe travels. I jog back toward the train and up the three steps where Mr. Kudrow stands, greeting each of the passengers as they board. I take the pen he had loaned me out of my pocket and hand it to him, saying, I wanted to make sure I got this back to you. It's a fine pen. Thank you for the loan. He takes the pen back from me and with a knowing smile, saying, Indeed it is. Welcome aboard. I'll be back to visit you in a bit. I return to my seat on the train, having discovered there is freedom in choosing the life you already have. There we go. That was a fun chapter because we got to name them because they were fictional people. Mm-hmm. So we used names of family members. I used my grandmother's name and we used the three of your children's
names. Yeah.
So that was fun. Because we couldn't name them after your brother and sisters because they were already,
named
about in the book.
So. I already had their names.
Yeah. did you have anything you wanted to say before I get into that?
No, I think we discussed it before you started the chapter and how important it was to have put this chapter in the midst of the travels, the final travels. Because final travels in the hero's journey are not always just final travels. There's some event that takes place during the return that creates a new element of character in the hero. And I think that's why this chapter was necessary. Not only necessary, but necessary to place where it was in the grand context of the storyline. So. It was a good place for it, and you did a great job putting it together. Ouch.
I think we needed to revisit the whole, because you're returning home, you're starting to lose that maturity you gained while you were in New Orleans. You're starting to go back home where you're a kid and everybody thinks of you as a kid, and being on the train where you were treated like a kid again, it was kind of like, my mom doesn't want to see me, and she doesn't have time for me, and she sent me off to boarding school. And here you meet a woman who's like, yeah, here's why she did that. Mm-hmm. Here's her side of the story. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have figured that out on your own. You wouldn't have understood that about your mom, because to a young teen, your mom is your mom. She's not a real person. She doesn't have a life outside of when you see her. You don't think about her, you know, going and doing all the things that she did with her life outside of being your mom. That's how we are. That's just how everybody is. So it was a way to project your mother's feelings and what she was going through on a screen in front of you with these children that this woman who was alone and frustrated was showing you an illustration of what your mom goes through when you're not around, so that you could have an understanding of, yeah, that's hard. And maybe instead of being a little jerky kid, I could be more helpful in the future.
I think it is the nature of teenagers, not only me as a teenager, but most teenagers, that they exist in the context of their own bubble, mm-hmm. without consideration of all the other bubbles around them. And it isn't until those bubbles intersect in some way, a three-dimensional Venn diagram, if you will, that they consider the possibility that they're not alone in the world with their own trials and tribulations and pain and anger. And, you know, it takes time to realize that everyone else has a bubble and they have their own things inside that bubble. And that until you come in contact enough with them so that your bubbles intersect and make that, as I said, three-dimensional Venn diagram, you're not sensitive to it. And that comes with age. And then you realize, well, one of the best things in life is really coming in contact with others enough so that you understand the bubble that they live in. I experience that with my own children a lot as we intersect in bubbles. And I try to advise them based on what they're going through and what my experiences were in the same matter. And I don't know that I necessarily ever describe it as my experiences as much as I describe it as here's how the world works. Mm-hmm. And it is, of course, from my experience, I try not to give them any advice that I don't really have an understanding of. And again, but it's that intersection of their bubble and what they're experiencing right now and my bubble and how my experiences might be able to help them to get through it. And there's something about that, the concept of that three-dimensional Venn diagram that one of these days I'm going to write a paper on.
Yeah. I can, it's why we give advice to our kids and, you know, when they're going through something with their kids, mm-hmm. you can say, well, here's my experience that I had with my kids. If that helps you, maybe, you know, then I've got the benefit of, for instance, I was talking with Ryan about Milo, and I've got the benefit of, you know, I can say, well, she's like Alicia in this way, mm-hmm. and here's what I didn't know, you know, like we didn't know when our kids were, you know, growing up in the late 90s and early 2000s, that they were developing computer programs for little bitty kids that mm-hmm. you could sit there with them on the computer and show them how to do all these things. And they were learning programs. So, you know, they were learning colors and shapes and, you know, they told stories and they had characters like Pooh Bear and Putt-Putt, the little car, and Pajama Sam. They were cute characters who were teaching them and they had little songs and everything. So it was very cute and it was very seductive because mm-hmm. they're like, wow, my kid needs to learn this because when they grow up, they're going to need to use a computer all the time. And the sooner, you know, the sooner they learn it, the better. And then over the years, we discovered that all of this technology had a detrimental effect on them. Nobody knew that because mm-hmm. it, you know, was the first time this was happening. This was new stuff. This was a new frontier. We didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, I believe that introducing kids to the computers and having them play with the computer that much when they were that young, still it stunted their people skills mm-hmm. so that they became more anxious. They were, you know, they would worry about interactions. They didn't want to go out of the house and play with other kids. They wanted to stay there and play with their predictable program that, you know, they had this relationship with. They had developed a relationship with a computer program instead of other children. Mm-hmm. So when I have the benefit of, yeah, here's what happened, you know, and I have all those years of knowledge, having seen her from the time she was a baby until, you know, she's now a full-grown adult, I can say to Ryan, here's what happened with Alicia. That's, this is what I learned from that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that information can help you make better decisions, you know. And I know that after we had that conversation, she curtailed Mila's use of the tablet quite a bit. So she heard that. She, you know, internalized that, yeah, that isn't good, and I don't want that for her. I want her to have those people skills because, you know, Mila is very good with other people her own age. She's good with kids who are younger than her. She's very active with her her soccer and other things that she likes to do. And you really don't want to stunt that, you know. She's at an age where that could happen if she keeps, you know, using computers and tablets instead of interacting with family members or, you know, doing other things. So it's just something that we have to, you know, we want to be able to show it to people in a way that's not like, well, you did this wrong and you shouldn't be doing that. No, I don't want to tell her how to raise her kids, but I do want to give her the advice of, here's what happened to me. And here's what I learned from that. And then she can make her own decision after that.
I had an interesting, and you heard part of it, I had an interesting conversation with Ryan about her visit down to Erica's house in Boca Raton, which for them is a straight 11 to 12 hour drive, but they always break it up. So mm-hmm. they'll stop in St. Augustine or St. Augustine. I don't know how they pronounce it down there.
We'll just call
San Agustin is how I want to pronounce it, but I don't think they pronounce it that way. So they made the stop on the way down, and then on the way back, they didn't. Mm-hmm. I have to clear my throat. And she said, oh, Dad, it was such a long trip, mm-hmm. and it was raining the whole time, so mm-hmm. there was a lot of backups. And what was interesting to me as she was describing the 11-hour trip through the rain and up by 95 in Florida and all the accidents as a result of the rain, she never mentioned the children.
Yeah.
She never said something like, oh, and the kids were just monsters and they couldn't get away to stop every 5 minutes. It was all the time, the rain, Tom getting tired, you know, me taking over. It was like very adult of her without blaming anything on the children. And I didn't push it. I didn't even ask, like, well, how did the children handle it? Well, obviously they handled it pretty well because she didn't mention it. You know, it didn't come up in the conversation.
Well, I know when we traveled in a camper, my brother and I would sleep as much as possible during the drive because it was boring, right?
This was not a camper trip. This was the big station.
Yeah, well, they're in an RV where they can lay down and take a nap.
Well, they all have little screens on the back of their seats or on the front of the, on the back of the seat in front of them.
Oh, this was in the wasn't the RV?
No. So the RV is a pull along, right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
So they can't go back there. It's against the law to have anybody go back there. This was just in the big, what is it, Tahoe? The big nine seat thing. So that's all it was.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how you get all the, considering the amount that they pack for each of those children, I don't know how you get all of that in there. But yeah, it was not a RV trip. Mm. It was just a truck trip. And like I said, she talked about the 11-hour trip and rain and I-95.
It's a long trip, yeah.
And never mentioned the children. Mm-hmm. And to me, part of the story of an 11-hour drive is how you had to stop every 5 minutes to correct the children. You know, and she didn't. So I assumed, as a result, the children weren't a story. You know, they weren't. They did whatever they were supposed to. And I think the fact that that all of them, whether it's Erica, Ryan, or Toby Renee, they have a lot of activities that they do, you know, with the children. Those little boys are out. I get video of Toby Renee taking walks with the boys and the dog. Mm-hmm. And it's part of their routine, right? And as a matter of fact, they are very routine oriented. I see them playing with vehicles. They do watch TV. I don't know if they're at the iPad stage yet, but they do watch TV, but it seems to be managed enough. The same with the girls down south. They have dance class. They have soccer now. Erica's going to start coaching. So they seem to keep them busy in a variety of areas so they are not stuck just behind a computer screen. Not that they shouldn't be, but the simple fact of the matter is their future is understanding computers enough to do whatever job they choose. So if they become doctors, they're going to have to understand what having access to, you know, systems that define the genetic code is. And so I like the way they're raising them in the sense of I don't have any control and I don't have any, you know, money in the game. But I like the way that they're doing a variety of things and giving them a variety of interests. And that's why I've made it a point every time I see one of them, I take something with me I've taken down microscopes. The last time I took a gimbal that I wasn't using anymore, but still very much in, you know, usable.
And the little hover that Mila got really attracted to. She wanted to do it herself.
The little hover air wanted to do it herself. And you can see having those things, you know, not that I'm ready to give all my children $400 presents, but my grandchildren, I mean.
But when we live there, they can come over and play with yours.
Well, that's the other thing too. We have one of my grandsons, Manny, Manuel, has come to the conclusion that I'm a billionaire. Because I bring these little toys with me and they're you know, toys, drones and things like that. And he says, Poppy, are you rich? Like, how much do you have? Is it millions? And I'll go, I don't know. You know, it's probably billions by now. And because I play with all these toys and I think they like them. I'm really looking forward, Shelly and I, when we moved to South Carolina. Well, I shouldn't say Shelly. Shelly and I are moving to South Carolina, and one of the things that I want to do is, because I've always wanted to be near water like that, is to start kayaking. And I would love to get them out there kayaking with us so that they can experience it. And I mean, they have a boat now, and I think they're going to get a bigger boat now that they're moving. But I would love to get them on the water and kayaking so I could share that experience with them. As well, a little bit of hiking too. I don't know if I know that they go hiking when they leave the area, go to North Carolina, things like that. So I don't think it would be a problem asking them to go hiking with you. And they always seem to be up for it. You know, they're healthy little kids. They're active, healthy little kids. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be a lot of fun for us.
Yes. Yes. Looking forward to it.
I hadn't seen that pendant in a long time.
Yeah.
What about that from our friend Marina, of Marina Feathers Art Studio in Santa Fe.
That's right.
Hand painted.
It's got a hummingbird on it. Mm-hmm. In case hummingbird is important to you. So let's get into the themes and emotions. The themes that this one is Miguel is grappling with the concept of freedom and the choices he has in front of him. The pros and cons list he makes reflects the internal struggle between the freedom of travel and the responsibilities of returning home. And you said you wanted to talk more about freedom further down the line. And well, I think we're there now, aren't we?
We are. And I think it's important to, again, define freedom in the context of whatever bubble in which you exist. And know that because we are human, and especially because we live in a country that's a democracy and has a constitution that basically states we have the right to be free. Being free is not the same as being free in the context of your responsibilities. And so what I discovered along the way is that you're as free as you allow yourself to be in the context of whatever you choose are your responsibilities. Because your responsibilities, generally speaking, are choices. You choose to get married. You choose to have children. You choose to take on a job. Those are not all things that you do to curtail your freedoms. They're taken on, and as a result, you have to redefine your freedoms. So I'm free to ask my spouse if she wants to have children. She's free to say yes or no. And so you move forward from that. And with each of these things, it's funny because you would imagine the choice to get married, the choice to have children, the choice to buy a house are all things that constrain your freedom. And in reality, as I said, they help you redefine what freedom is. When you own your own house, you have the freedom to choose how you want that house to look and how you want to develop it and how many times a week you're going to mow the lawn. And some people look at those as responsibilities. I always looked at them or how do I choose to be free in this way so that it's not like a house doesn't tie you down. A house frees you. A spouse doesn't tie you down. A spouse frees you to explore other avenues of life that you previously would not have explored. Having children is not something to tie you down. It's something that enables you to choose how you're going to experience freedom in the context of all those other little bubbles that you're raising around you now. So I wanted to talk about it only because freedom, and there's a song someplace where the words, I think, include freedom. Freedom is not being free. Freedom isn't free, right? Freedom is how you define your willingness to experience freedom in the context of what you've chosen to be your responsibilities. Now, can you ultimately, with no responsibilities, no house, no spouse, no children, no debt, a check that comes in every month help you survive, can you experience that kind of freedom? My experience is that even when you think you're being free by, let's say, getting off the train and heading down for Central Mexico, you're never really free. You can't ever really be free without making choices that in some ways either constrain your freedom or require you to redefine what freedom is for you. And it's always for you. It's not for everyone else. And understanding that and learning to live with that is one of the indications that you're maturing. And maturing like that will make you feel better about yourself. And when you feel better about yourself, you feel better about the rest of the world.
I was just looking for the name of somebody, and I couldn't remember. was a survivor of the concentration camps during World War II. And he talked about that even though he was in a concentration camp, he was in basically a prison, he still had control over his own mind, his own thoughts. So that, I think, was such an effective way to look at things that we look at him as somebody who survived that and who was very much confined after having been, you know, free to pursue education, become, I think he was a psychiatrist and a doctor, you know, had his doctorate. And he was just a very intelligent man that he could figure out, yeah, I'm locked up, but I have a choice here. I have a choice on how to behave. I have a choice on how to react and respond to this situation, to these things that are happening to me. I may not have a choice about every single thing that's happening, but I get to choose how I respond. So, and I think Miguel kind of comes across that as I may not be choosing to go out on my own in Mexico and find work, but I still get to choose that I'm going to go home on this train. I choose to be more helpful in the future to my mom. And, I choose to be a good son. You know, all the things that he can choose are still his choice. They're still his, he gets to decide how he's going to be, how he's going to respond to what comes next.
I know from experience that some of the great thinkers from, I don't know, Marcus Aurelius forward to where we are today, always talk about the amount of time they spend experiencing the freedom of being in their own minds. And we've evolved as creatures, human creatures, we've evolved in an interesting way that included the evolution of our mind to daydream, right? That had to evolve. But it went just from thinking about what tiger you're going to hide or hunt next or whatever you were doing as an early human. Our brain evolved so that included in all the things that keep us from the very basic things of breathing and running our heart to staying alive, getting food into our mouths and into our gullet, to experiencing what it's like to flex your imagination, to flex your daydream. You know, we always talk about night dreams and the stories that are told. Night dreams to me are just kind of I don't know why we do it, but I don't find them as productive as daydreaming. And some of the great thinkers in our history have always indicated that part of their regimen for growing and evolving in thought and their thinking included just spending time in their own head, daydreaming or imagining or exploring. And I know there are other stories of individuals who spent time or in prison or in concentration camps, and in their mind while they were there, rather than destroying themselves internally, they wrote books or they imagined movies that they would make when they were done, and then they went and did that. So it's a wonderful characteristic of the human animal that we have the ability to daydream in a lot of different ways, imagination or exploration or just thought. I always envy stories about people like Einstein. Not envy, that's the wrong word. I always enjoy hearing stories about people like Einstein and Oppenheimer who could run these things through their head before they put a piece of chalk to a blackboard or a pen to a paper, because it was all imagined in their head first and then explored in the form of writing or speaking or making presentations or whatever. And that for me has always been an exciting part of being human. I don't know if animals can daydream. I don't know if they can imagine. I don't know that anybody knows. I've never read any papers on this topic. I know that they dream, right? They experience dreams because you can see puppies running in their sleep and cats, you know, fighting in their sleep and things. But one of the things I love about being alive, being a human, is that even when I don't get down a lot, but when I get down, I can just close my eyes, sit down, close my eyes, and play around in my head. And that always makes me feel better. I get to imagine things. And you know very well that I go through my phases in life. And as I explore them, I sit back and I imagine, what's it going to be like to kayak on a river in South Carolina? And now I'm looking at videos about people advising you what to do when you see an alligator when you're kayaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you brought it up, you know, that's right. And I thought, I haven't had that experience. What am I going to do with that? So I get to imagine it. And then as you watch the video and collect more information, you let your imagination run around with it and you start thinking, well, what am I going to do? Right. And it's like always, let's get off the X. But it's different when you're in a kayak. Getting off the X is different when you're in a kayak on a river that could be, you know, as narrow as 25 yards or something like that. So I am really happy that however I acquired life, that life was given to a human creature as opposed to a kitty cat, for lack of a better way to describe it.
All right, let's move into responsibility and family. The encounter with Dorothy and her children highlights the theme of responsibility, especially in the context of family. Miguel reflects on the burden his mother carries and realizes that leaving would add to her challenges.
It's choices. It's one thing to you get married and have children. It's another thing to be a part of a member of family that you didn't have any choices. Yeah. You were born to them. Your brothers and sisters were born. So you have to choose how do I make sure that all the bubbles in this family are healthy and good and come in good contact? Those are choices. And you can choose to be a member of a family, or you can choose not to be. And sometimes the choices are made for you in the sense that you realize this is hard to be with this family, or this is not the family that I wanted. I may have told this story before, but one of the I had a lot of difficulty with my sister. She got progressively older because she became addicted to a lot of different things. And it used to make me sad, but I couldn't break through that. I couldn't get back to the Venn diagram 3D bubble with her. And one time I was telling my daughter how frustrating it was for me to try to engage with my sister. And my daughter said something that was so simple in its brilliance that I'll never forget it. And she said, "Dad, she lost her father too, at the same time that I did. And she was younger, as were my brothers. At the same time, I was 11. They were, you know, 5, 8, and 9. And so it was important. It was eye-opening for me because she had the same experience and she had the same mother, and I had the good fortune to be sent off to a boarding school guided by Christian Brothers and then college. And although she went to college, my brothers never finished high school, and they got progressively worse. I mean, as the younger they got. And my youngest brother died in his early 30s. My next brother spent half his life in prison before he just disappeared off the face of the planet. And so it was eye-opening in that sense, and I had to consider myself fortunate in the choices that I made. The question that kind of gnaws at me today is, could I have done more? Could I have spent more time with them? Could I have acted more like a father rather than a big brother? And we'll never know the answer to that, because literally I have outlived my entire family. I'm the one remaining member of the Toby Yunus and Angelita Delgado family. So if you ever find yourself in a situation where you ask this yourself the question, could I have done more? The answer is yes. You could have done more. The matter that you should be asking, or what you should be asking, is what choices do you make that prevented you from doing more? And I know those choices. And I can sit here and regret them the rest of my life, or I can accept that I could have made better choices and never allow it to happen again. So,
well, I have to disagree with you a little bit there, because each of us is on our own journey. You can't be responsible for somebody else's journey. You know, just like when Kevin was dealing with cancer, I could not be responsible for his journey and what choices he was making and all of that. I was thinking today while I was on my walk that had my mom not had those strokes, had she been in good health, I might not be moving to South Carolina. I might be moving to Arizona to be with her. But now, because of the strokes, and she's, you know, but there's nothing I can do to make her better. There's nothing I can do to improve her life at all. You know, she's got to be where she's at, and it's not going to get better. So I have to, you know, then at that point, that's her journey. I have to let that go. I can't make her life better. I can't take care of her any better than the people who are taking care of her, who are trained in that. So at that point I have to say, okay, then I need to focus on my own journey. What do I want? What's next for me? And, you know, you have to let go of other people's journeys. You cannot, sit there and wonder what if, and have all those regrets that you didn't do more, because it was their choices that they had to make on their own, because they have free will. Even if you had been in their face about it, they probably would have brushed you off and said, "Leave me alone, it's my life," which it is. There's only so much we can do for other people. There comes a point at which we have to say, it's his journey. Let me focus on what my journey is. So just a little disagreement there. Whether you can do more or not is dependent, completely dependent upon them. And if they wanted that help, then they would have asked you for it.
Of course, it's made even worse by the fact that they're all gone now and there's nothing I can do.
No.
You know.
Then you just have to keep telling yourself, you know, I did what I could with the tools that I had at the time, just like everybody else does.
I felt like what I was doing was creating a good example.
Yeah. So at least maybe their kids could see your good example and, you know, how your kids turned out. And maybe they'd go that route instead, which I think, you know, maybe Santos had a little.
He had a literally, he had that moment where he goes like, this is not what I want for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So we all have to make our own choices. That is our freedom. That is that is our, not only our freedom, but it's our responsibility. We can't just pawn that off on somebody else and say, I don't know, you decide. Because if it doesn't turn out, then it's your fault. Because not making a decision is also a decision.
What did you do this morning?
We're not going to talk about what I did. Mm-hmm. We had breakfast. They got there. All right. I think we've come to the end of this episode. I guess I did want to talk about the symbolism of the fountain pen. Because when Miguel took the pen with him, when he got off the train, and then, you know, he knew it belonged to Mr. Kudrow. So it was like, I'll take this pen, then I have a reason to come back on the train. What was that about?
Well, you wrote it, so I don't have the benefit.
You made the decision about the pen.
I did make a decision about the pen. So, So as I walked off the train, the pen was just in my pocket. The reason it became a symbol of the return with a boon, right? Mm-hmm. The small boon, because you always return, the hero always returns with a boon. Had he left at that point and crossed the border and headed off down to the oil fields of Mexico and maybe survived life another 2 years if he was lucky, at the point that he decided not to, it became a boon as he walked onto the train and he could tell Mr. Kudrow, and who knows how much Mr. Kudrow knew about what he was feeling, right? Mr. Kudrow didn't know that there was a point at which he considered the possibility, that Miguel considered the possibility that he was getting back on that train. And Mr. Kudrow, the only thing he would recall about it was, dadgummit, he was such a good boy and he took my pen. And so the pen, I think you're right to consider it a symbol of part of the journey. The pen was, it was Mr. Kudrow's to begin with. It wasn't acquired as part of the process, but he could step up back onto that train and tell himself, well, I had to bring this pen back. It would have been wrong for me to leave without it. Could he have said, here's your pen, I'm leaving? Mm-hmm. He could have. Mm-hmm. But at that point, because of the conversation he had with Mrs. Dalton, he realized, no, I've got to finish this out, that it's not a journey, that by leaving, you know, whether it's leaving New Orleans to head for the coast or leaving the train to head down for Mexico, his journey is not going to come to any conclusion that can be rationalized, that can be story told, you know, it doesn't end. It's just yet another story. And who knows how many of those you can survive. How many people have told him to get an education? Mm-hmm. You know, there's some point at which you say to yourself, maybe I better get an education.
Yeah.
And I doubled down on that because I got, not only did I get a college education, but then I joined the military, which is a completely different kind of education. And so I think the pen represented the acceptance, the return of the pen was not only the symbolism of returning the pen, but it was the symbolism of the acceptance of moving forward with a choice that he was making about the rest of his life. And the choice that he was making at that point that he handed that pen over was, okay, I'm going to go back to school. Hope they accept me back at St. Mike's. Hope I can reconcile with my mother enough to provide some form of consolation in all of that for me and for her. And then go on, finish high school, get a scholarship to college, finish college. Although I didn't complete it until later. I never expected to go into the military. That was literally I don't want to call it a spur of the moment. I thought about it for several days beforehand. Because I saw it as a possible choice. The choice was like, it's a way to get away from Santa Fe, but you're jumping right into the middle of a really ugly war. And I never regretted it for one moment. You know, were there hard days? Yes, but I never regretted that choice.
So it seems to me that the fountain pen represented, when you return it, you're being responsible and mature. If you would have kept it, it would have been childish and irresponsible.
And it would have hung with you. It would be the kind of thing that you had for your entire life, waiting for an opportunity to go down and look for trains going by that you could see whether or not Mr. Kudrow was on it so you could return that pen. Mm-hmm. And it would have haunted you for the, it would have been the kind of thing.
You're the type of person that, but yeah. This journey helped you become that type of person.
Yeah.
So the last line is, I return to my seat on the train, having discovered there is freedom in choosing the life you already have. And we talked a lot about that when we wrote this chapter. There's freedom in choosing the life you already have. Making that choice. And I think there's a lot of people in situations like, especially like marriage, you have to choose every day. I'm going to stay being their mom. I'm going to stay being his wife. I'm going to stay being, you know, who I am. I'm not going to blow it up today, even if I feel like it. You know, every day you have to make that choice. I'm going to be in love. I'm going to, you know, be a part of this family. Those are choices that we make every single day. I'm going to keep going to my job. I'm going to keep, you know, whatever it is that you've chosen as a commitment, you have to choose every day to stay committed.
I think it's not a matter, for me, it's never been a matter of good choices and bad choices because I've made both. And I suffer the hangover of the bad choice. For me, it's always been choosing or not doing anything, not choosing. Mm. And I think the more time you spend, the more you don't choose something, the more likely it is that circumstances are going to carry you with them in this wave of a surf that you're not going to have any control over. Choosing is freedom, not choosing is not freedom, because then you're in control of the universe, and you never know what the universe is going to do to you.
Okay. On that note, I think we have covered everything pretty well with these two chapters, and next week we will continue on.
I'm going to write a paper on 3D Venn diagrams.
Finally, arrive at in Laney
and have to deal with it. Yeah.
And paying the piper. So join us for that. And if you enjoyed today's show, I hope you'll share it with your family and friends and maybe even read the blog post about it and dive a little more deeply into the topic. What do you think?
I think reading your blog post would be a great experience for anyone that does.
Yeah. And we also have a newsletter that comes out every Tuesday. And we update people with what's going on in our lives. This week we are...
Oh, hang on. I got to get there.
A newsletter?
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, there it is, news.agkmedia.studio. We update people on what's going on in our lives and, you know, just thinking about what the holiday season is coming up and, you know, make sure you take time to just enjoy family members and friends and, you know, connect and don't worry so much about you know, getting presents and shiny packages and trees and lights and everything else. That's all, you know, gravy.
And there's a little baby angel waiting for us in South Carolina.
That's right.
With a halo and everything. A
little baby. So that'll be a great Christmas gift for us.
I think so.
So thank you for being here today. We hope you had a good, good time with us, and we'll see you again next time.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.